5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening it is, and I can't believe it is already. It is Thursday night, 9:37. Well, it's actually 9:34 Central Time, and so that song finished a bit quicker than I expected, actually. It's a nice surprise. And it is the new Panic Room, episode 141, would you believe? And, yeah, just funny enough, I just got an email through, pinged through, inviting me to listen in to the show. So, yeah, thanks. That's great. Yeah, I'm glad they reminded me sort of 3 minutes after it started. So anywho, yeah, you know, I'm gonna hit this button now.
Come on, I'm with you.
Come on, I'm with you.
Well, Xtina, how are you this evening?
I'm good. You know, the funny thing is I used to cringe whenever I would hear that, you know, the opening. I would cringe. And now it brings a smile to my face.
I just can't introduce you, can't bring you on the show without playing it now, really. That's kind of, it's like that's your theme tune now, unfortunately.
There could be worse. You know, I was going to say there could be worse things, but I'm not sure if they're really.
I can't imagine what, to be honest with you.
Exactly.
I really couldn't imagine what, but there you go. It's sort of redneck special needs sort of music. But, it seems to say you've got that. So that's my legacy to you.
Thank you.
You are welcome. You're most welcome. I'm a bit button friend, a bit button sort of mad this evening. I'm going to press this one.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
I'm going to go for the record, see how many buttons I can press in one show. So, hey, Xtina, what is new, pussycat?
Oh, let's see. You know, I always pretend like I know what's going on. The only thing I can think of that's new is, are we going to announce the audio Blood in the Woods? Is that new? Is there anything?
It is
okay,
new. It's so spanking brand new. We just got the confirmation like 10 minutes ago. So it's as new as it gets, really. It's as new as a new thing on New Day in Newtown.
I'm excited because, you know, of course I got to listen to it all. And the narrator is awesome. It's an awesome book. It's just, I highly recommend Blood in the Woods by, what is it, J.P. Willey?
J.P. Willey Joe, who is a tremendous guy. Tremendous guy. He's well deserved. I mean, he gets... You know, good review after good review for the book. I had the pleasure of editing it, actually, which was tremendous. It was an honor to work on it. And it's just a great... Scared the shit out of me, to be honest. Made me cringe in all the right places. But it was a... And all the more bone-chilling for the fact that it's based on a true story.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oddly enough, Joe Bay, he tapped into the they call it the Satanic Panic in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and of that same era is an upcoming title from us called Satanic Panic, which again taps into that era when everybody was supposed to be devil worshipping and sacrificing children. Aspect gorgeous and that, which to be fair, I missed out on. Maybe in my little corner of Doncaster, South Yorkshire, they weren't big on Satan, unfortunately.
You know, I kind of sadly
missed out.
I remember being young. I don't remember. I would say early, maybe tweens, and I had an older cousin, and our family talk about him that, you know, whisper, he's a Satan worshiper because of the music he listened to. You know, that was all they were basing it on too. And I can't even, to be honest, I can't even remember what it was. And, you know, that it couldn't have been anything worse than...
Ozzy Osbourne or something, or anything like that.
Black Sabbath,
Satanist. Definitely. It's like, seriously? Yeah. Seriously? You know, and even now, I mean, it's funny, I sort of in the late 80s, I worked in a laboratory, funnily enough, with a guy who was into thrash metal.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, he played some and said, what the, seriously? And it's just like, ah!
Yeah.
No. Stop it. You know,
it just sounds like noise, but
that?
I think that's my
it
age.
Is just,
yeah.
It's white noise. It is just white noise. I mean, I don't know. I'm sounding old. I do get, you know,
no,
you can't hear the tune.
Really.
There's no good tune. You can't hear the lyrics, so it's rubbish. You know, it's like rap. My eldest, you know, he looked at me. He was he actually did some rapping in his day. And he used to look at me like listen to this and like, well, it's just people shouting over good music. You know, because they call it sampling. Yes. Well, that's the thing. You say, "Oh, listen to this," and my daughter now does. My 10-year-old, you know, she's like, "Listen to this," and it's like, "This is," and there's sort of, there's one that sampled, "It's My Party and I'll Cry or Cry If I Want To," whoever did that originally. And it's like, "This, oh, this is not," because it's new to them. So I remember the original. How old am I?
Yeah. I think that's
one thing. You know you're getting old when you recognize, you can sing along to the samples. But of course, you know, in any other terminology, it's plagiarism. It's like saying, from my latest novel, I've sampled Stephen King's It.
Oh my God, you should try that. Yeah.
Just putting big chunks of Stephen King's It in your novel and then writing over it in pencil crayon and saying,
yeah, you know, it's
a sample I've wrapped over it, you know.
I like it.
Maybe it's worth having a go. You know, we should do that. You know, I'm going to sample Clive Barker for my next novel. You know, it is. It's just plagiarism and people shouting over perfectly good music. He said, sounding incredibly old. Very old indeed.
I'm right there with you. You know, I can't. I remember, you know, with Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. You know, and to be, I did not know for the really, because, you know, Queen was a little bit before I really was into, like, you know, rock music.
He just totally ripped off.
And now I definitely.
It's funny enough, actually, I had the pleasure of seeing Vanilla Ice live a few years ago. I went to took the kids to a football game here in Houston, and he was like the halftime entertainment. You know, in England, they just, you know, you go and get a pie and peas and have a wee, and that's your halftime entertainment. Of course, here they put an act on, you know, because obviously the American public can't be trusted to be left alone to their own devices for any length of time. It's funny, actually. I digress on that. This is why you are a nation of, I don't know, people can't concentrate. You're a nation of just dumbass people, to be honest. And I can say this because, you know, you are a former colony of ours, so I'm allowed to say these things, you know. When, again, many, many years ago, I remember the first time I went to SeaWorld in San Diego, it was. And it was fun. We sat there waiting for Shamu and whatnot to come on. And in the period of time from sitting down, rather just sitting down and just, you know, on the big screen there, they played the show.
Because
people couldn't sit there for literally 10-15 you know, minutes while everybody sat down. They couldn't just sit there and either chat or sit there quietly. They had to be entertained. This is the thing. You people have to be entertained all the time. It's constant. It's like going to a comedy show. Yeah, you go to you're going to a live comedy show. You go to see, pick a contemporary comedian that's not British. I'm trying to think of somebody now. It was a good American comedian. Nope, there aren't any. Ricky Gervais. You're going to see a Ricky Gervais live. Yeah, and a big, big fan. If you're listening, Ricky, thoughts and prayers, mate. and while you're waiting for him to come on, in that period of time, you know, they play his stand-up show. It's exactly the same. Yeah. Just learn as a nation. Learn to just sit quiet. We had a thing when I was at school, going through school, in sitting quietly. That was a part of a lesson. You sit quietly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, before the lesson started, you sat there quietly. If you finished your work towards the end of the lesson, you sat there quietly. Or you got a book out and you read, sat quietly. Yeah. And as a nation, the Americans, you need to. It's like Donald Trump. He needs to learn to sit quietly for 24 hours a day. To be honest, that would be terrific. Because you see, you see him speak, you see him in action. You know, he has to fill in the gaps. He can't not talk. And this is the problem, because he fills it with bullshit and lies.
Yeah.
I was watching, I saw a report the other day. I've got a fly on my glass, guy. saying that since he's been in office, he has told over 10,000 lies or untruths.
Wow.
Or misleadings, which equates to 12 per day. 12 lies. So that's one lie every 2 hours for the duration of his presidency so far. You know, and I think a lot of it is because he has to. And it's funny, I mean, obviously, yeah, the way I was brought up, plus as well, being a trained salesperson as well, the art of the silence, you know, if you're in an argument or if you're in a sort of a sales situation, that silence, you know, you pose a question and the first person to come out of it, break the silence, was lost, basically. It's a psychological thing. And Trump needs to learn that. He just needs to learn to shut up, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I don't like to, well, actually I do. I like to talk about the boyfriend. I like to call him out because I know he's listening to the show. But,
hi, boyfriend. Love you lots.
He can't sit through commercials. And, you know, like on your phone, if you have like an ad that will come up, he, you know, pays to get rid of all those ads. And if there happens to be one 4 seconds long, he's like freaking out. And I'm like, you know, what do you really need those 4 seconds? I just sit back and, you know, I like commercials. I do. If I'm watching regular TV, which I don't think we have regular TV anymore, but, you know, I don't mind the commercials. I really don't. He'll turn on like a movie and then get up during the credits. Like, no, the credits are fun. You get to see who, you know, who's starring in the movie. And, you know,
I love the credits.
Yeah,
relax.
Yeah, exactly.
I like to see who's in it. Even like The Simpsons, you know, The Simpsons. I still watch The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And I love guest to see the stars. Credits to see who the guest voices were, you know. And my kids are the same, you know, most of the stuff we watch now is, you know, we've DVR'd it or it's recorded or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can just flick through. When I was a kid, you know, literally, you know, the adverts came on, the commercials came on. That's when you went to the toilet. You know, that's when you went for a wee or you went and put the kettle on or, you know, you did that. Or you sit and watch. I mean, obviously, the whole point is you sit because people are lazy. That people sit and watch the commercials, you know. And even, you know, but even now we just... I find myself doing the commercials come on. You know, if I'm watching something live. So what do? I get my phone out and start flicking through my phone. Which to say, if I'm driving, I don't text them. I try not to use my phone when I'm actually driving. Come to a red stoplight, got my phone out. We're going to check my email because it's like 2 minutes since the last stoplight and I checked my email. Something might have happened. Something might have come up. Something important might have happened. And it never has. Yes. Never.
No.
Not ever.
And you know, if you actually unplug for even, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours, you know, it is so peaceful. It's so relaxing. I will go through like a withdrawal. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm missing, you know, but then
I'm
after
missing
I
out.
Get over that.
I'm missing
yeah,
out.
But
yeah.
After you get over that, it's very relaxing. And I think we should all do it frequently. I do.
They should have an unplug day. You know, one day in a week where you literally just unplug and you disconnect from online and all the rest of it and watching movies is fine, you know, but just disconnect from the internet and all the constant chatter
outside.
And noise.
Yeah.
It's funny when I tell the kids, you know, back in my day, even before car phones, you know, I used to be on the road a lot. I used to work in sales a lot and you were on the road and you listened to the radio.
Yeah.
And that was that, not on the phone. And it's just like, and it was great. You know, if you needed to speak to the office, you'd get to a pay phone, remember those, and you'd phone in.
Yeah, I do.
I remember when I worked for Duracell, at the end of each day, having to find a pay phone and actually phone my orders for the day in.
Wow.
You know, it's just like, it was just like, wow. And then I got my first car phone, and then obviously the car journey turned into right, I could catch up on my phone calls and it's got out of hand, I think. It really has.
Mm-hmm. It really has.
But the kids, you know, I mean, when we have, you know, for a couple of times a week, me and the kids will sit and have dinner. We'll cook dinner and we'll sit and have dinner. And we have a strict no electronics at the table rule. And we will sit and for whatever it is, half an hour, we'll sit and we'll actually talk. We will communicate, and this is, you know, the kids sniping at each other, but it's conversation. They're interacting, and it's great.
Yeah, it is.
But it's communication, damn it.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, and here's a segue. Speaking of communication and whatnot, what have we got on the show this evening?
We have an exciting show tonight. We have a returning guest, horror author Chad Shimke. And for our second segment, we have a poet, Roman Newell. I'm
poet,
excited to speak.
Was it Roman numerals? That's great. We do not have enough poets on this show. Obviously, your good self accepted, of course, because you've been known to write the odd line of poetry, I'm told. Let's bring Chad. I'll let you introduce him.
Okay, returning guest, horror author Chad Shimke. Woo!
Hello, Chad. How you there, sir?
Hey, I'm here. How's it going, guys?
Hey, we're good. Hey. Good. Hopefully, we didn't. We were just. It's funny. We get waffling on sometimes, and we forget that there's guests waiting. So I do apologize.
Oh, no worries. I was just listening to you go on about the Sounds of Silence, I guess, or unplugging, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. We all should do that more often.
Yeah, but not on show nights, because it would make for a very boring show if you sat there in silence, you know?
That would be a really awkward interview if I just did it now. So I shouldn't do that, right?
Right, we're going to disconnect now. Just have 90 minutes of silence.
Right, that would be strange. Okay, so we're not going to do that.
It would still be better than all the other horror podcasts out there, to be honest. So.
Oh no, we can't say that about those people because they're our friends.
Oh yes,
definitely.
No, we can.
Okay.
Definitely. Yes, we can. Definitely. They're all rubbish. They're all rubbish.
I can't say that, but maybe you can. I don't know.
I can. No, you need to remain neutral on that one, but I can say they're all rubbish because I can.
All right.
So, Chad, thank you for joining us again. You're here to talk to us about your book, Tales from the Campfire. A terrific tagline. It's a charity anthology filled with 24 amazing horror stories. Hang on, why was I not invited on this one then?
That's one of the things I'm going to talk about is sort of where the inspiration came and the day that all that came together. So yeah.
I do tease. Written by Northern California authors. All profits from the book sales donated to the North Valley Community Foundation's Wildfire Relief Fund, which is terrific. What a great, great cause. So, yeah, tell us the story behind it, Chad.
Okay, well, I go to meetings of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the Horror Writers Association, and there happened to be a day that I remember. This was in November. And it was close to the Thanksgiving holiday, so it was maybe a week or two before. Here in San Francisco, the sky literally turned sort of this pink, gray, brown color. And in certain times of the day or the evening, the smoke would actually pick up, I think, kind of an orange sort of pinky hue to the fires. This was a huge, huge, huge fire. And it was north of San Francisco, obviously, there's a small area of Paradise and up there. And so going out and about, I mean, I still had a million things to do and had to be in and out of the car and going all around the city. But the smoke was so bad. My eyes were watering. I couldn't breathe. I had a cough. And really everybody I saw in those couple weeks was in the same condition. So this wasn't like a normal sort of annoyance. I mean, this is a really, really big deal. A lot of businesses closed. A lot of things were just kind of not available. For some reason, all of us at the Horror Writers group, still kind of showed up and got together. And the discussion actually came up, Ben Monroe, one of our group members brought up a suggestion about what would it be like to put together a collection of stories to publish an anthology. Another one of our members, E.M. Markoff, has an imprint, has a small press, and, you know, and I forget the specifics of kind of exactly what came to play at what stage in the discussions. Later on, Ellis Johnson did editing. The final editing was done by Lauren Rhodes, and we all contributed pieces and put this book together really kind of in a very quick manner, but sort of like that notion of, you know, many hands were involved with it. So I did read most of it already, and of course I wrote one piece for it, but I read a lot of the, especially the group members of the group I know, that, you know, the people I have kind of been hanging out with for the past, you know, 6 months to a year or whatnot, and it's really great to see this, like, diverse collection of horror stories that are all really quite different. So what's interesting is sort of how they intersect thematically, but also how they're all so different, and they really have such a fresh take on horror. I'm just so excited by this book. Also, if you're kind of keeping an eye on it on Amazon, so this is kind of amazing to say, it's already number 3 in bestsellers for horror anthologies. So it's getting, like, great reception, and today is the release day of all things. Yeah, so that's a bit about the book.
That is brilliant. That is brilliant, and a worthy cause as well. Yeah, I mean, you must obviously, you know, we see the reports about the wild, and it's just horrific. I mean, people are losing their homes, and there's hundreds of thousands of acres are just being burnt up. I mean, it's one thing you don't think, consider it as being more, like you say, more than annoyance. I mean, it's a health. I mean, I guess people who have asthma and breathing problems anyway are really going to be struggling if you know, people without problems are finding it difficult. I mean, is it that big an impact on daily life over there?
Well, during the time, absolutely. And when all was said and done, it is now California's worst national disaster on many fronts, on the economic impact, on the impact of wildlife to the tens and hundreds of thousands of acres that were burned. You know, prior to that, there was a huge fire in the Los Angeles area of the Griffith Park fire. It surpassed that. And this is San Francisco, that is no stranger to our kind of, you know, fame disasters of the earthquake of 06.
Of course, yeah.
To the Loma Prieta earthquake, to even the year before in the Sonoma area, I think particularly around the areas of like San Rafael and Santa Rosa, the Tubbs fire. And so this area is no stranger to disasters. And this one, the campfire, has definitely taken first place for California's, you know, worst natural disaster. So it's had a huge impact. Due to what happened to Paradise, the nearest town nearby is now the number one real estate market in the state. So it's caused an influx of people to go into that area, and it's had a huge impact. So, you know, that's all over now, but I still don't think that the true economic and the toll on, you know, personal lives is fully known. I mean, we still, in the course of, like, working on this book, there's always sort of personal anecdotes coming up about, you know, this person knew somebody who lost their house, or, you know, there's a tweet about some personal connection to it. You know, my parents are retirees, and they have a life of leisure and traveling, but on their travels they go to, you know, stay kind of in national parks and RV parks, and they personally met someone who was living out of their RV at an RV park due to the fact of him losing his house. So it has a very real personal impact on people, you know?
Yeah, that's terrible.
I lived in Florida for many years, and we did have there was one time where there was a wildfire that was it wasn't close enough that, you know, I had to worry or anything, but I'm telling you, there was a time where, you know, just going outside your house, you know, you would see the ash. I mean, and it was like, it looked like it was snowing, and just the air was just awful. So I can't imagine. I really can't. And, you know, that's probably one of my worst fears, I think, is fire. So having a wildfire that, you know, mm-hmm. you can't contain, that's just
well, that's the thing.
Pretty
scary.
They try to
control them. That is pretty much, you know, they're at the mercy of the elements, really. You know, a slight change in wind direction and, you know, it just goes off, and it must be terrifying, really. You know, obviously.
Well,
you know,
we had those very things. I had a layer of ash on my windshield, and of course the breathing problem, like I was telling you. The sky was literally orange and brown.
Wow.
And then, you know, initially, I know you mentioned, you know, President Trump earlier, you know, one of the first things he said is he blamed, you know, he incomprehensibly blames the people there for things like not managing the forest properly or misspending funds.
Sweden had shovels. Something
it's crazy.
Okay. Thank you, Donald. Thank you. Thanks for that. Yeah. Great.
Right. Things that never happened and wouldn't have made any sense or any difference anyway. He was like overruled.
This is the guy. Bear in mind, just after we'd been through Hurricane Harvey here, which it was what a couple of years ago, came to the basically the refugee center here, where all the displaced people could have been flooded out were, and said, "Hey, what a great turnout we've got." So this is this
right.
is the guy. This is the guy. We're dealing with. Sorry. Go on, Chad. What you said?
Yeah. Well, I want to mention. Just a little bit about a couple of stories, and I want to, you know, talk about a couple people and what they wrote. I think that's important. So we each contributed pieces, and I got to go back a page. Okay. Sorry about that.
No problem. We can take that out in post-production. You're all right.
Okay, so mentioning a couple pieces. One of the, you know, so there's some really great stories in this book. I want to talk a little bit about each of them. There's a lovely piece written by L.S. Johnson, somebody who goes to my Horror Writers Association meeting. It's entitled Ada Awake. It's got kind of a lovely gothic vibe to it. It's about a peasant who goes on a journey and goes to a French chateau. I'm not going to give away the ending, but she's carrying a mysterious artifact with her. I'm going to mute this. And there's a great reveal at the end where this person discovers her true powers. So it's great. Another story written by Ken Hewler. It's got an interesting vibe to it. There's a Japanese exchange student who snoops in her father's attic and finds something that sparks like a supernatural confluence, and in that discovers not only this like secret hidden in the attic, but also the limitations of her father's love. And how it ends is abrupt and startling and horrifying. So that's a cool story, too. We've got another one by Anthony DeRuin, who is organizing a film festival currently, the Death Parade Film Festival. This story is entitled The Patron, and it's about a bartender who has a mysterious visitor. Okay? And then there's my story, which is entitled Vivified. I wanted to write a story about resurrection and what happens when you die and you come back to life. So that's kind of my piece, and I hope that gives the listeners and the readers like a little bit of an insight to what the pieces are contained. There's 24 short stories. There's a lot more than those I mentioned. One of the contributors is also Ian Markoff, who wrote a story about a sister that takes the bus to the end of the line, and there's a supernatural confluence that happens in that too. So stories that are we've got gothic influences, supernatural influences, paranormal, some things you might think of like kind of supernatural monsters like werewolves and Cthulhu like H.P. Lovecraft. And so there's a lot going on, and it's a really great collection.
Wow. Sounds like a lot is going on. That's awesome. I don't know how much time we'll have for a reading. We might have to cut you off, but I'm excited to hear a little more. And, you know, I say that because, you know, our second guest is a poet, and you're going to start we're going to start at your reading with a poem. You know, we should just have poem night. So, do you want to do the reading, Chad?
Yeah. How long should I go for?
Oh, well, I'll just you know, nudge you if you're going over.
You'll jump in and let me know. Got it.
I will. Yeah.
All right. So this is an excerpt from Vivified. It begins with a poem, and then I'll go into a little bit of the opening of the story.
Okay.
Poem entitled Dead End. An urgent coyote's howl, the lonesome hoot of an owl. A rapid rushing brook. Stop, glance back and look. Razor sharp barbed wire, she simply must climb higher to a hidden place where it's surely safe for a hare. She counted 1, 2, 3. Who's left? Only you and me. Long, loud man's machine. A twisted, grisly, tangled scene. Blood stained crimson red. Alive once and now dead. To spurn, to quicken, to mend. Cross the threshold to live again. Cliff Braun didn't have time for mediocrity. He cracked his knuckles while waiting for his PC to boot up. The dial-up modem whistled while it connected to the ISP. When the spreadsheet corporate emailed him finally decided to open, he pressed the intercom button and spoke. Can you send in the assistant manager? Yes, sir, right away. The receptionist's voice sounded tinny on the little speaker, punctuated by an annoying, short, shrill ring. Cliff took a swig of coffee from the mug that read, Investment Properties, with the subtitle, A Great Company. Less than a minute passed before the door opened. Good morning, Mr. Braun. He checked out the assistant manager. Her bust almost burst forth from her conservative blue pinstripe suit, barely buttoned over a filmy white blouse. Cliff Braun, but please, call me Cliff. Bianca Chastain, my pleasure to meet you at last. How can I help you? He'd read her personnel file at corporate and already knew she was one of IP's best and brightest. She smiled, and he thought she would have been great in the sack. Maybe he'd swing by one day next week and ask her out for a drink. How in the hell could she say no? He cleared his throat. Samuels, Carruthers, Howard, Masterson, Tracy, Phillips. Sir? I'd like you to go to HR and get a pan prepared for each of them. I'll sign and you can take the paperwork to accounting to get checks cut. I want you to hold a termination meeting with each of them before the office closes. Pay them overtime just in case you need to stay late. Got it? She paused a moment, her lips pursed. She looked defeated, like she needed to worry about her job, too. Corporate had kept a close eye on this branch for the last 6 months. She must have known he never needed to be here if things were going well. Yes, sir, I'll start and get right back to you. Thanks. Close the door on your way out. He picked up the phone and dialed. Hello? She answered. He'd always thought she would do anything he wanted. Boy, was he ever wrong. It's me, he said. Silence. The sound of breathing, but no words. I'm taking the train today instead of driving. It's going to take me longer to get there. A small gasp. You scared me. Relax, will you? He asked. Do you know how many times she asked each day if you're coming? Well, I am coming, okay? I'll believe it when I see it, she said. Come on now. Would it be the first time you bailed? And don't forget to buy her a present. He'd forgotten. Of course, I'd never forget. I'll get there pretty late, but I'll get there. I'll leave the key in the usual place. He hung up the phone. Before he left the office, he'd wash his hands, then head over to the train station. Maybe he'd run into Bianca on the hallway on his way out. He fluffed his wavy brown hair with his fingers. He tugged his dress shirt taut across his stomach. He wondered if the crow's feet at the corners of his eyes were noticeable. He hadn't slept well. He never slept well. He'd miss his 5-mile run later tonight, but only for one night. Whatever, he'd promised. It would have been nice to drive instead of taking the train. Damn his mechanic for not finding a way to get his car back on time. Excuses. Always excuses. More BS. Cliff walked to the reception desk to sign the stack of personnel action notices before leaving. On the way out, he passed the desk and read the name tag, Mitch Samuels. Samuels sat slumped at his desk, brushing donut crumbs from his dress shirt. It seemed like he stared at the page forever, a fat, unmoving sloth. What a sad schmuck. Cliff wasn't anything like this loser. Sorry, buddy, you're getting fired today. Cliff took the elevator to the lobby. Outside the building, the sun hit his face. The lively sidewalks were filled with young professionals hustling to their destinations. Shining edifices of steel and glass arched upward, glinting in the sun. When the stoplight flashed, pedestrians swarmed in every direction. He walked through the downtown business district. Rows of trees and planter boxes lined the sidewalks. Green shoots sprang forth from rich black earth. Spindly urban trees bore their first leaves. Birds wove nests to be filled with squirming pink fledglings, downing meals fed from their mother's beak. Cliff would be sorry to miss tomorrow's weightlifting. He'd have to hit it twice as hard next week. The train station. But first, he needed to pick up something. Was it on this block? He turned right and spotted a hunter green awning, DuBose's toy shop. One display window was filled with dolls, the other piled from top to bottom with toy trucks. Typical and boring. He swung the door open and a bell tinkled. He immediately had to dodge the children scrambling underfoot. He didn't know where to begin in a place stuffed with wall-to-wall crap. The beleaguered lady behind the cash register appeared flustered, bravely facing a long line of impatient mothers. Cliff felt hopeless. Just then, a woman popped out from behind a glass case and said, "Can I help you?" Her flyaway hair distracted him, and he noticed she made a pen mark on her hunter green apron. Yes, please. Cliff felt a pang of relief. I've got to get something for a little girl. She's 6. What do you suggest? Could it really have been 5 months since the last time he'd seen her? Let me think, she said. What is she like? Stuffed animals, I guess. He hoped he was right. She lowered her eyes and scanned the bookcase next to him. She snatched a slim book off the shelf, excited to show him the front image, a row of brown bunnies dressed in little outfits on a red background. She smirked as she flipped it open to a picture of a brown bunny wearing a pink dress holding an egg. She shoved it into his hands with an urgent look, seeking his approval. Well, what do you think?
We're gonna have to cut you off now. I'm so sorry.
No.
Okay. I know.
I was enjoying that. We need Chad on for a full show so he can read everything.
That would be fine by me.
That'd be great. No, you read incredibly well. If you don't have a second career in audiobook narration, if you want.
Thank you. I've been told I have a voice like a radio announcer on multiple occasions. So yeah.
Yes.
That.
Yeah, you have got a good roast. Yeah, you should do. We've got a few books we need narrators for, so we'll give you a shout.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Now, I was actually thinking it'd be kind of cool to get some of the other guys from the anthology and maybe doing like a whole show and just having, you know, bits and stuff. I think that'd be kind of cool. So I'm gonna get with you after the show. Yeah, I'm gonna get.
Yeah, they would love
show.
That and be so appreciative of that. I think.
Yeah.
That's over to Xtina to organize that. Get that organized.
Definitely.
Young
definitely,
miss.
I will. Yes, sir.
Great.
We're just about out of time for our first segment. And can you tell us where we can find you online, Chad?
Yeah, I think the best place to go, there's a lot of places, obviously. I would just recommend you go to my blog because you're going to find everything linked up there instead of giving out different addresses, but everything I'm mentioning, especially Tales from the Campfire, Lauren Rhodes, E.M. Markoff, you know, Ben Monroe, Ken Hooler, Anthony DeRuin, everybody's going to be listed there in some way, shape, or form. You can all find them in the book. Best location is to go to my blog. Gets great traffic, and it's updated way too much because I spend way too much time on it. But you'll always find stuff, so that's good for you. So it's my first name, last name, Chad Shemke, chadschimke.blogspot.com. If you just even type in my name on the internet, you will find a lot of stuff. So check it out.
Awesome. Definitely. I will get your links put up on our Facebook page. So if anybody wants to stalk you, then go there and do it. And again, thank you so much for coming back on the show. And I will. After the show, I'm going to get with you and see if we can organize something. And I can't wait to have you back.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Look forward to it. Okay,
thank you, Chad.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we will speak to you again soon.
Talk to you later. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. And we will be right back. Bye-bye. We'll be right back after these messages.
The Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
Want your kiss, cause I just can't miss with a good luck charm like you. Come on and be my little good luck charm. Ah, you sweet delight. I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. To have, to have, to hope, to hope tonight. Don't want a silver dollar, rabbit's foot on a string. The happiness and your warm caress no rabbit's foot can bring. Come on and be my little good luck charm. You sweet delight, I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. To have, to hope tonight. Toss it across the bay. Your love is worth all the gold on earth. No wonder that I say, come on and be my little good luck charm. You sweet delight, I want a good luck charm hanging on my arm. To have, to have, to hope, to hope tonight.
Welcome back to part two.
Well, we is back. I'm back. I don't think it's Christina back. How you doing, my dear?
I am. I was dancing in my feet.
Feel free
to join
in. It's your show too, you know. I know you don't do much, but, you know, seriously. Mate, put some effort in, woman.
Like, the only thing I don't do is push the buttons. That's, like, the only thing I don't do.
but to be fair, you have to admit the buttons are pushed incredibly well.
Hang on.
Got you, fucker. So this fly has been pestering me all afternoon, and it's bugging me now. And it's just like, they taunt you. They do. They do taunt you.
They do.
I'm going to crawl on this now. It's going to piss you off. I'm going to crawl over. I was crawling on a bit of dog shit earlier, but now I'm going to crawl over the rim of right on the rim of your glass where you're going to put your face. Bastards. Seriously,
they're evil. They are.
Seriously, I tell you what I'm going to do just to get my own back. I'm going to go outside and I'm going to tread in all the dog shit. See how they like it. So the flies can eat. They can eat what I've trodden in. So think on.
Dear. But no, I was going to say, you know, about the button pushing thing. I tried once, I remember, and it failed miserably. So, you know, I know, listen to you.
I think we abandoned it so within like 30 seconds of the show, didn't we? Because you just couldn't cope.
It was just like silence. Yeah.
You couldn't breathe and push buttons at the same time, so...
I couldn't. I
remember that.
So, you know, I think we have a perfect combination, you know, of, you know, button pushing and you know, the other stuff and, you know...
You mean like everything
because, you know,
else.
Without the other stuff...
Everything else completely by yourself.
I wasn't going to say it, but now that you did, no, there definitely would not be a show without both James and Xtina. So there is that.
No, do you know that? I flatter myself that no, there were. But no, to be honest, listener, I do absolutely fuck all. I turn up 2 minutes before the show starts, press the buttons, waffle on for an hour and a half, and then go to bed, and that's pretty much. Xtina, she organises, and there is actually a book in existence. She organises the book. I'm a guest and all the rest of it, and gets people on to act. It's just, which is amazing because she's actually incompetent with everything else she tries to do. So I'm absolutely amazed that she can achieve. Oh, hang on, do you know I hit it? I hit the fly. And it just flew off. It like flipped me the finger with its little feet. And fuck it. And it's flown off now. It's supposed to be dead. I hurt my hand.
Yeah.
I,
yeah.
on the and it's and the fly's still flying around, you know. So I hate it. I hate it. I think what's happened is my ex-wife has died, and she's been reincarnated as that fly.
As a fly.
And she's,
oh my
she's
God.
Built that specific fly, and she's just come back to piss me off even more. So you know,
it's
thank
possible.
You,
yeah.
Thank you, baby Jesus, for that one.
Wow.
So
no,
so I think we're in one of those. We're having one of those shows today. We're just, so we've offended every other horror podcast out there. we've just
yes.
offended all the people who like Baby Jesus. Who can we offend next, Dina?
Well, we offended Trump lovers. You know, we did do that. We succeeded
we
doing
did.
That. During our
That's show. Another one.
Yeah.
Chalk that one up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, we possibly trailer parks, you know, I mean, I don't know if you actually
rednecks.
Said trailer parks. Rednecks, there we go. Yeah, rednecks.
It was,
so.
if we didn't say it, it was certainly implied.
Definitely, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we're doing good tonight. We're doing great.
We are on a roll. We're going to have a pop art next, I think. But just be careful,
definitely.
Be careful. So, hey, what have we got coming up next, my dear?
I'm excited. Our second guest is poet Roman Newell, and he recently had a book. Well, I don't know if it's been like a I don't know how long it's been out. I think it's maybe about a month or so, but he had a new poetry book out, and I can't wait to get my hands on it because, you know, let's bring him on.
We should bring
that?
Him on, and you can try and wangle a free book out of him as you do. So let's bring him on. So Roman,
yay.
Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Hey.
There you
go. So before we start, Extina wants a free book. So let's get that out of the way.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
you know, I.
But book sales are going so well that I was about to walk down the street today and give them away for free. So that lets you know where I'm at.
Fantastic. Well, say, Xena
yeah.
will give you an address at the end of the show. You can send her a few. So.
yeah, you know.
Sorry, go on, Xena. I'll
no,
just
I was
going to
say that.
Shut up, shall I?
Yeah. No, I was going to say that, you know, we're both in the group on Facebook, The New Romantics, and I see your poetry all the time, and it's always so deep. You know, I think that definitely for me, when I write, there is never hardly ever any hidden meanings or, you know, any metaphors. There's just what you see is what you get. And when I read your stuff, I'm just like, all the time thinking, okay, is there something in here I should be getting, you know, and I'm trying to like dissect it. And it's just, it's so deep. I you amaze me. You do. I think you have really, really amazing poetry. So, you know, all jokes aside, I definitely am going to get the book, and I can't wait to read it. So, how long has it been out now?
So the last book, and for anybody who doesn't know, it's probably everybody, When Life is Cold, You Move Fast, I think I published it about a month and a half ago now, on paperback at least.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And that was a pretty interesting title there. So how did you come up with the title for the book?
Yeah, so, you know, I've had a number of different you know, live casts on Facebook where I've addressed this, but 2018 was not a super fantastic year for Roman Newell. I went through a lot of difficulties. You know, I was in jail for a while. I'm now completely sober because of a number of my difficulties. I had a lot of financial issues. Without going into detail, let's just say that 2018 wasn't super amazing. So that book was born out of those experiences. And the title is really based on the idea that when life is difficult and you have to make fast decisions, you know, like the cold, hot cold kind of represents just a difficulty of living life. Especially in, you know, maybe a difficult period of life. And for me, I just had to make fast decisions. I had to do what I had to do to survive, to live, to make it. And I think that a lot of people can probably relate to that, you know, at some point or another in their life. Everybody experiences, whether it's a month or whether it's a couple of days, you go through a period of time where you're like, shit, I don't have time to wait for the 100% solution, I'd have to move fast. I have to make something happen. So that's really what it's about.
Wow. And I will say that, you know, a lot of the times when I'm reading a piece of yours, I'm moved because it's just, it's gritty and it's real. And, you know, I think that a lot of times, especially, I think that a lot of times in poetry, we tend to hold back a little bit. You know, I mean, I do remember a challenge that I saw from you one time about, you know, to not hold back. And that's difficult when you think about it, because, I mean, even in my own poetry, you know, I always thought I was pretty open and pretty, you know, I bared it all. But, you know, I really didn't. I did hold back. So I think that's I think it's amazing that you can just strip it all bare and just lay it out there and you know, whatever happens, happens. Because I do think that we, you know, tend to try to...
It wasn't always that way, you know, and so one of the things that I try to do is I try to educate, and I don't mean that in like a deigning way, you know what I mean, because mm-hmm. it's part of the natural progression as an artist of any kind, that the most difficult part of being an artist is to find your own voice, you know, and to be authentic to yourself on whatever level that means. And I think I've just been fortunate to be writing now for so long and to have gone through enough clarifying, and when I say clarifying, I really mean very difficult experiences in life, that I just got to mm-hmm. the point where I was so comfortable with my own story and owning 100% of who I am, the difficult things as well as the good things, that it's easy for me to write about that because I'm no longer worried about what people think. But mm-hmm. I mean, but when it comes down to, you know, stylism in art, you know, there's all kinds of different, you know, styles, and you know, not everybody wants to read, you know, that kind of poetry, you know, and that's true. Completely true. But for me, I think I found that, one, that's just kind of who I am. That's really where I'm most, it's kind of like my pocket, you know, where I flow the best. But I think that mm-hmm. there is kind of, just because of the way that our world is set up today, nowadays, we do live in a very PC culture. And I think that there is a segment mm-hmm. of our population, at least, that is kind of fiending for that. You know, they kind of, it's kind of like water for the soul to find somebody, even if you don't agree with them, you know what I mean? And without getting mm-hmm. too political, and let's just say that I hate all politicians equally. But I think that in a way, even if you dislike a man like Donald Trump, or you dislike somebody that you disagree with massively, there's a certain level of refreshment that comes with just unadulterated rawness. You know what I mean? In a way that's refreshing, even if you don't like the person. And so mm-hmm. I just think that our, you know, our society is kind of just prepped right now for kind of a renaissance of sorts of rawness in our art.
You know, I guess I can definitely say I agree with you because, you know, along with, you know, being politically correct or whatever, people are offended by everything. And I think that, you know, there have been certain, you know, certain lines of certain poems I read of yours, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that, you know? Really, I'm like, but it's awesome. It's like, you know, wow, he actually went there. And there's been times I went back and like, I have to read that over again because I'm, you know, I'm sure that's not what he meant. Oh my God, that's what he meant. Yeah. that's awesome. It really is. You have you picked out two poems, I think, to read for us, correct?
Yeah, I have two waiting in the wings. I didn't know when you'd want to hear them, but
Do you? I would love to hear them now. If you have to, like, maybe set them up or something, or tell us, you know, about them or something.
No, I have them sitting right here on the screen. But I was going to speak to what you were saying real quickly, and I think that it's interesting because I have time, and especially I have a couple of collections that I'm working on right now to release in the next 2 to 3 months, which I'm really excited about, even more excited than I was the last one. But I kind of got in this new frame of mindset when I was writing where I stopped trying to over-intellect it, and I would just let my subconscious just go, even though I didn't know where it was going. And then at the very end, it was like my subconscious was telling my conscious self something that I didn't know consciously. That's a lot of kind of confusing, right? But it's like the inner self was trying to tell me something about myself that I needed, whether it's for healing or for a positive direction in my life or just to add clarity to my life. And so all of a sudden, the act of writing something, once I let go of the control It's like I was learning something, you know, and it became a very self-revealing experience for me in a completely different way. And even though I had things that I was like, man, that's really intimate, or that's really dark, or that's like really bloody and raw, once I let that stuff go and I put it out there, the response to that has almost, and this has been consistent for me as I've become, I would say, kind of more and more open about myself and things that I've gone through. Like, the one consistency is that it's been received really well by people. And I think it's because so many people are, you know, as humans, we go through the same things. We feel the same emotions. You know, we experience things maybe in slightly different ways at different times. You know, we may not all end up divorced, or we may not all end, but in some way we feel the similar human struggle. And I think that's why, you know, the more that you put out there that honesty, that vulnerability and transparency of self, people just relate to it. Like, they just do, you know? And every time that I think I'm going to turn somebody off, it happens sometimes, I won't lie. But by and large, people just really feed into it. And I think that they just enjoy having that made available to them, so.
Definitely. And I liked what you said about, you know, just, you know, going with it. There was a time, you know, as writers, as poets, I think that there are times when we have something in us to write, and, you know, for whatever reason, it's not coming out or something. And I just recently I went through this where I was itching to write a poem, and I wasn't really sure even what about, but I had an idea of, like, the first line is all. I just had the first line, and in my head it was going to be romantic. It was going to be some kind of sensual romance thing, and just from that first line. And I don't know what happened because what came out was something totally different. And it was one of the ones that I looked back at it and I was like, oh, I can't show anybody that, you know. And I was even like, what made my mind go to that? And but now, you know, looking at it now after it's been completed, I'm like, wow, it's powerful. But I don't know where it came from, and I don't, because that's not where it started, which,
And it's like you're trying to tell yourself something, you know what I mean? And I think sometimes that we hurt ourselves as artists because we try to fight. What we really want to do artistically, but maybe it hasn't been validated yet, you know what I mean? Or maybe it's something that hasn't quite been done. But in doing the things that are unique to you, ironically, that's where our power as an artist lies. But we fight it so much, and everybody goes through it, you know? And mm-hmm. it's such an irony about the progression and the evolution and the maturity of any artist, you know? And everybody goes through it. It's just, it's part of that artist human struggle, so.
Definitely. So it's all yours when you want to read for us. This is
okay.
This is my favorite part.
I'll give you the first piece here. It's a poem. I chose two different poems that I've read a little less than other broadcasts, you know, be it on Facebook Live or whatever the case may be. This particular one, well, I'll just read it, and then I'll give you some context afterward if you like.
Okay,
it's called
definitely.
At Play. At Play. Between inspiration and reluctance floats driftwood, once used by young boys to play army. They're dead now. Skeletons locked in vanity mirrors where widows apply makeup and cry it all off. They push vignettes to unborn sons. They do not suppose. They do not hope. They no longer swim. They do not play pretend with young sons of their own. They cannot even dissuade their beautiful patriotism.
Okay, so tell us about it.
So if you know, and I don't know, you know, how much either you probably more than some of the listeners know about my background, but I was in the military for a while. I was in the infantry with the 82nd Airborne. I deployed twice in the infantry with them to Iraq and Afghanistan, spending about a year and a half collectively overseas in those two different combat zones. And then growing up as a young boy, you know, it's interesting to me because I think a lot of times people look at our military personnel, to speak for here in the States, and there's a sense of, there's obviously become a huge barrier, a much bigger gap between our just core civilian populace and then those who, you know, since we are an all-volunteer service now, you know, those who raise their hand to go serve. And it doesn't make anybody better or worse. A lot of people go to, you know, they want to serve purely out of economical reasons or just, you know, whatever the case is. There's a lot of different reasons. So it's not about that at all. But there is a lack of understanding around what drives the people who go do it to do it. And I think that sometimes there are assumptions around the way that we view what we are sent to do when we come back. And what I mean is, you know, are they just blind patriots? Are they just kind of just, you know, are they just thoughtless drones that just want to go over there and do the bidding of their government without any additional thought? And so I'm going to speak to that very quickly because I honestly, I think, you know, we grew up in it. Like when I grew up, you know, I'm 33, so I'm not, you know, I'm not super old. I'm not particularly young. But, I mean, I did grow up in a world where we pledged allegiance to the flag, and we had those markers of, you know, loyalty and allegiance and patriotism that have kind of been weeded out of our everyday society. And, you know, there I'm not going to say, you know, that's bad or good, but it certainly is different from the world that we live in today. But it definitely inculcates you with a certain level of inherent patriotism and this idea of loyalty to something that you don't necessarily question when you're young because you're young. You know what I mean? You think that everybody has their best interest in mind when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, by the time that I turned, you know, 17 and I was looking to go to school, I ended up, you know, applying to a school that I had no plans on applying to. I didn't have any plan to do anything involving the military, but I did very well in school. And so all of a sudden the opportunity to attend West Point, you know, arose. And I was like, well, this sounds like, you know, not even for the military aspect of it, but just the challenging part of it. I was like, this sounds like a great place. You know, it'd be a great challenge for me. And the kind of people that I'd be around would be the kind of people, it'd be strong cohesion, a great group of people to help push me to grow and become better. And those were all the thoughts going through my head. And then, and this, of course, this is, you know, this would have been 2004. So we're talking 3 years, really only 1 year into the war in Iraq, 2 years into the war in Afghanistan. And you have no idea at that point what that's really going to look like or how long that's all going to last. And you're like, well, I'm going to graduate in 08, you know, so, you know, whatever happens, happens. And now, of course, it's 19 and we're still in Afghanistan. So there's that, right? But
you're right,
all of those things happen. And I compare the way that I think now to the way that I thought as, you know, a 17-year-old first going to West Point to, you know, begin a career at an academy and eventually become an officer. And I am much more aware and awake of things, you know, that relate to our world, to like our political maneuvering in the world and all those other things. So, you know, coming back, I have a very different view of the kind of patriotism that we try to instill in our kids. And, you know, having my own kids one day, I'm thinking, okay, I would never want to tell my kids what to do, think, or believe, but what I do believe in is unbridled, objective education. So I say, hey, you know, you make your own decisions for your own reasons. Life is complex. It's complicated. But you need to understand that, you know, not that many people have your best interest in mind. We live in a very Ayn Randian world where people are looking out for their own self-interest, and that's just a fact. I tend to be kind of Randian-esque in the way that I view the world. I think that most people ultimately, I think that the world is based on economics. And because of that, people are looking out for their own self-interest. And that's just a very human basic thing. What makes us human is the ability to be able to transcend that and to utilize and import compassion into the world. But that's a difficult thing. That is not our base tendency. Right. And so because of that, education is the way that we protect ourselves. So that's a very long, long-winded way of getting at this poem, which is essentially trying to compare this idea of like young patriotism with and the way that boys play and where that comes from. Right. You know, with this kind of final, like bleak, you know, kind of morbid picture of now that boy's grown up and now he's not there because he's been killed in battle. And now his, you know, widow is left there and he doesn't even get to be there to, you know, to instill or inculcate the same patriotism that ultimately killed him in his son, you know? So it's kind of this round robin type of thing. So there you are with my very long-winded explanation.
No, I love it. I do. I think that, you know, for me, when I read poetry, I like, you know, the more personal, the better. And I do think there are many times that I read a piece and I'm trying to, you know, figure out what of this is them, you know, what is the personal aspect? Because for me, that's what poetry is all about, to make you feel, you know, and so I'm always dissecting it to be like, oh my God, what's, you know, I don't know. And your stuff is so visceral, I guess, and real. It's a good word, isn't it? So we don't run out of time here, do you? Do you have another poem that you're going to read for us?
Yeah, I have one more for you guys. This one's a little bit longer. Yay. And actually, this one still kind of harkens back to the military, which I didn't really intend to. But again, I think things just happen sometimes. I'm a very fly-by-the-seat-of-my-pants kind of person. I don't know if you've noticed that.
I don't plan anything either, so cool.
So let's see. This one is called Stillness. We are often killed by things that stand still. We go to them, move like captured enemy, shackled one to the other at slow, consistent pace. Heads down, we identify mud, squishing between the tread of our boots. We feel the steel against skin. We feel the suction cup earth. We feel the weight of ghosts on our shoulders. Conviction has left us. Smokes have lost appeal. Pain from the cold sets in, becomes familiar, then turns us numb. We are always looking to the sky for God, but he is in the mud. We wear him on our worn souls and on our shirt sleeves. Like a last name on uniform, he goes with us. But a man never looks down at his own name. The trees stand their ground, slowly changing, remaining rooted against the greatness of life. Nothing hurries. There is a patience to the pain. Slow progress, track forward of track. The prints tattoo the ground. Drizzle leaves the sky like a sad London chap with no family on holiday. Life is heavier than love, like a pigeon carrying its entire nest away from a storm that has not yet arrived. Dignity becomes bonded diligence, a book spine worn over time with the lifting and pressing of each step. The rain is ragged, tired, sluggish, and straight in the way it falls. There is little art to it, but it makes its place in the dirt. It tenderizes into mud. Like a press, the boots squeeze out the wet, then lift. The wet returns. Again, the boot squeezes, and again the wet returns. The trees watch with all their quiet patience while the captured carry on, while their fraying boots with their unnoticed god.
You know, you could just read your poem. We should have a whole show where you just come on and read poetry. That'd be so much fun. It really would. So do you want to tell us about this one? Or
sure. I mean, in a larger sense, without breaking it down too much, because sometimes actually there is less deep meaning in some of the things that I write than people think sometimes. That's God's honest truth. And then other times there's more meaning in pieces that seem simpler. I mean, honestly. I think overall in this, go ahead.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, it's funny that you said that, because there was something I wrote, I don't know, about a month ago, that somebody said, you know, oh my goodness, and they were just seeing all these deeper meanings, and I'm like, wow, you got all that? Because that's not what I wrote, but it's cool. You know, and of course I wasn't going to say that, but that's awesome. So go ahead.
Well, you know, speaking to that, that's interesting too, because I recently – anybody who's been in my home knows that I always have one book for sure on my bookshelf, and it's a very long form version of Howl by Allen Ginsberg. And what I love about it is that it has all of his, it has like photos of his original handwriting. And so what you get then is you see his process. And so when you get to see a writer's process, that changes everything, right? Because you get to see kind of the incremental development that went into his the genesis of each idea, which is like very intriguing to me to get it into the minds of people. That's always something that I love. But but this particular poem, you know, in a larger sense, I tend to be kind of a realist. But I think a lot of times what people don't understand about my writing style and my content is they think, wow, this just seems really dark, Roman. It just seems really down. It seems like you're always depressed. I mean, you don't know how many times I've posted a piece of writing and had a number of people reach out to me and say, Roman, are you okay? Like, are you gonna hurt yourself? I'm dead serious. And right. And what I always say is, I'm always like, guys, if when I stop writing, that's when you need to be worried. For me, mm-hmm. it's such a cathartic thing. And the way that I frame my poetry, no matter how dark it gets, if you look carefully, there's almost always a small, like, flicker of hope somewhere in there. There's almost always, like, a small silver lining of beauty in there. And to me, that is the beauty. To me, it's not trying to take huge events in life and trying to convince people that it's all beautiful, because it's not all beautiful. But it's to take those large events, those difficulties, and then be able to, like, spin them in not, like, a political way, but in an optimistic way that is grounded in a certain balance of realism, but also hope. And I do think that hope is important, but I think that it has to be counterweighted by a certain level of realism about the world that we live in. And I think that pretty much speaks to my entire philosophy on life. So.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, and it's funny too, because, and you're so right about the frame of mind you're in, and, you know, poetry is very, for me, very purging. There was, you know, my first book, Dark Musings, there were, a number of the poems in that book ended basically with, you know, the girl bleeding out, you know, dying to, you know, and just, but it was a dark period in my time, in my life, you know, and I do know a number of people who, you know, asked me if I was okay. And, you know, even my mom, you know, she loved my writing, but she would tell me it's so dark and so depressing. And that's where my head was then. I mean, it's hard to write about unicorns and bunnies when that's, you know, that's not where you're at. And, you know, on the flip side of that is that, you know, my life right now is going wonderfully, you know, everything is just so great with my life. And so it's hard for me to capture the darkness that I, you know, that I had with Dark Musings, which I think is, you know, some of my best, you know, writing was in that book. But I can't duplicate it now, you know, because I'm not in that frame of mind anymore, which is great, you know. But I remember saying, you know, I said to the boyfriend once, I'm like, you're just really bad for my writing career, you know, I mean, because now I just, you know, I'm writing all these love poems. What the hell's wrong with me? They can't call me the dark poet princess anymore if I'm not dark. You know, maybe I'll have to, you know, if he pisses me off, maybe I can kill him in a poem and then I'll feel better or something. But so far that's not happened.
Well, it is funny. I think that a lot of people fear that. You know, I went through a period where, and like I mentioned, I'm sober now, have been for the last 30 days. So that's cool for me. It's something that I needed for my life. But I really had this genuine deep fear that without like alcohol there to lubricate, because I had relied on alcohol so much to feel. Like, I couldn't cry without drinking, you know what I mean? And I had a sit-down with my therapist where I was, you know, very open with her and said, I really have this fear that if I'm 100% sober, I'm not going to be able to tap into that element that made me what I thought was a good writer. And, of course, you know, to my happy dismay, I realized that actually it was suppressing it and that actually I've become even more creative and more had a better work ethic, you know, since being sober, which, you know, is just for me, but that made me very happy. But it was, I think a lot of writers fear, whether it's, you know, a substance related thing or whether it's just, you know, life changing, or sometimes it's luxury related. Like look at a lot of like musicians, right? Once they make it, it's kind of their fear. They're like, am I going to be hungry enough to make the same quality music? And so that's definitely something that I think we all think about.
Yeah. And I have to say, I have to, you know, since I have you on the show, I want to give a quick shout out to RB O'Brien. And, you know, I have a book that's going to be due out at the end of this month. And I kind of owe it, you know, a lot of the, you know, the writing to her, because before I read Ruin My Lipstick, I was only a rhymer. I mean, I didn't even like to read poetry that didn't rhyme. And it was some of her poems in Ruin My Lipstick that made me decide I'm going to try free verse. And I haven't looked back. I haven't written one poem that rhymes since then. which is awesome because I feel like I've grown a lot as a writer, even though James likes to joke around with me because he's like, it doesn't rhyme. It's not a poem. It doesn't rhyme, you know. So,
yep.
But, yeah, I think we should try to get together, maybe, you know, me, you, RB, and we get some other people, and we just have a whole show where we just sit back and talk poetry. I think that would be awesome. So
it'd
we have
be great
to work
fireside
on this,
poetry yeah. chat. Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. But we are just about out of time for our show. Can you tell us where we can find you online?
Yes, and I'm so used to let me give a quick shout-out to my PA, Darlene Terrell. She is absolutely incredible. She does way more work than she should do on my behalf, and she puts up with my attitude, which is always in flux. So thank you, Darlene, for all the work that you do. But yeah, you can find all the works on Amazon right now. There are a couple small bookstores that I'm in, but it's all local here in Madison for the moment, hoping that changes in the future. But for now, Amazon has my catalog, and I think it's all up on – I think it's all cataloged in a single author page, so you can find it all there.
Awesome. I will get your links put up on our page, and if anybody wants to stalk you, they can go there and do it. And you said you had some things coming out in the next couple of months, so I definitely have to get with you and have you come back because this is great. So, oh, yeah, you have to promise to come back. You promise to come back, right?
I promise to come back. I promise to come back.
Yay!
Can I come back as well? Am I allowed
yeah.
I have to say, I've been quite obviously, you know, it's very rare we have poets on it. It's a treat for Christine, and it's great to listen to. I mean, poetry. Anybody who knows me will know poetry is a mystery to me, to be honest. And it's great to listen to two poets talking about their process and all. Somehow, poetry just seems to be deeper. It seems to run deeper than, you know, us who write our usual stuff. You know what I mean? Prose, you know, grown-up writing or whatever you want to call it, but I think it's something
grown
more.
Up
it is. There is something. I think, as you said, it's more raw. It's a more raw form of art. So hats off to both. It's been a pleasure to listen. Just sit back and listen. Actually, it's been great.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Excellent. No, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm afraid it's that time, Xtina. We have to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile? Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there. And they die there. Are you warm? Are you real? Mona Lisa. Are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art. Do you you smile to tempt the lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there, and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art? Mona Lisa.